This interview with Dr. Mike Rickard is part of the Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program involving retired staff members of ANU who were part of the university in its early years. The Oral History Program was initiated and developed by ANU Emeritus Faculty as a contribution to university and community understanding of the beginnings and development of the ANU over the past six decades. Emeritus Faculty has a special interest in this period since the faculty's membership includes many of the people who helped shape ANU in those early days to make it the preeminent university it is today. Mike Rickard joined ANU as senior lecturer in geology in 1963 and was later reader in geology and deputy dean of science. He contributed extensively to new teaching programs and to academic development generally in the geology department and in the Faculty of Science. Mike's research interests were in field geology and tectonics, in which he published extensively. He was, at different times, secretary and president of the Geology Society of Australia. In 1995, following retirement, he was elected an honorary member and fellow of that society. He was a foundation member and fellow of the Australian Institute of Geoscientists, the body which oversees professional practice in geology. In 1996, he was awarded the A.B. Edwards Medal by the Geological Society for best paper in economic geology. More recently, Mike has written a history of geology at ANU. Thanks for coming in this morning to talk to us in the Oral History Program for Emeritus Faculty. And this talk will be mostly to do with your ANU years. But just to get things started, perhaps you could give me a few words about your origins. You were obviously an immigrant to Australia. Could you tell me the background to that, please?
Yeah, well, starting the beginning, I guess I was born in London, outside of London. My parents, my father was in a merchant bank until the Air Force, and then he came out and trained as a school teacher. He was actually quite a good amateur artist. He painted for many years until he died at 91 or something. I was started to get interested in... It's interesting that four out of the 16 people in my sixth form became geologists, although I never heard of any of them since. And we never had any geology teaching at school. But I wanted to work outside, and I was mainly from scouts. I was very interested. A couple of kids in the scouts were doing geology. And I thought, this sounds interesting. So I went along to the local tech and did night school geology, just sat in on it while I was in high school. Things were tight at home with the money, and my mother was quite keen for me to go to work. Dad wanted me to go on. I got offered a job in the naval research, gunnery research, as a young kid. I suppose I was 16 or so then, and the idea was you do higher national at night school. And I thought I'd accept it, but we didn't have a telephone, and Dad said it's too late to go out on the phone at 10:30, and I slept on it in the morning and decided no. And I went off and got into Imperial College by chance.
How many other children were in your family, Mark?
Three. I've got three brothers.
Three brothers, yeah. Were you the eldest?
I was the eldest. Right. The second one did what I would have been done, work for the Navy, DSIRO, or DSI, whatever it was called, research, became electronic engineer. The third one became a farmer, and the last one went into the RAF. Spent most of his time underwater in the RAF, and he's still a keen skin diver and that. When I went for an interview at Imperial College, it was a bit worrying because the final, talking to the profs we had to do then, the final comment was, well, if we need a new high jumper next year, we'll let you know. And I thought, oh God, you know, I'm trying to emphasise school things and that. Interestingly, 20 years later, I went back and met that same professor at a JOLSOC meeting, and he said, are you still high jumping? And I said, you've got to be joking. So I did quite well in high jump. I became county champion. I got blues, or purples as they were called, for athletics in London. But when I got too heavy for athletics, I got somebody buttonholed me in the street and said, we want you in our rowing team. And I said, well, I can't row, we'll teach you. So I rowed in two heads of the river while I was a postgraduate student. family background, I used to commute, of course, in on a motorbike or push bike into London, 12 miles every day. I was fit then. I'd cycle 8 miles, row 4 or 5 miles for training, and then another 4 miles into uni, and then cycle back 12 miles at night. I was very keen on scouts, senior scouts. Did a lot of hiking. We did a lot of potholing with them. And in geology, I was, as long as I kept off the math side of it, which we had to do surveying. And I did zoology as an accessory subject, interestingly enough, with the same professors in the same department as Adrian Gibbs and his wife, though yes, they were a year behind me. So I had a good time there. I came out with a first. I then went on. Everybody's working in Scotland mainly for structure there, but I had gone at the end of first year. I've been invited out with, because I asked Wally Pitcher, was there somewhere I could go in the field in the summer holidays, because we didn't have any fixed term at the end of first year. He said, come with me to Donegal, which I did. And so then he persuaded me, and I went back to Donegal to do my PhD and spent 15 months out in the sticks.
So you did your PhD in Donegal?
Yeah, from Imperial College.
I see, yeah. Right. Yep. So they
that was the field area.
A base there, yeah.
Well, it didn't have a base. You just went over there and I booked into a house, you know. In fact, it's very funny. The first time I arrived on my motorbike in this village, there was a guy leaning against the wall. And I asked him where was somewhere to stay. And he said, well, there's a hotel. Oh, I can't afford that. And he said, well, that place over there takes in boarders. And then I found out afterwards that the lady had seen me, because everybody knows what's going on in these villages, and she said to the girl who worked there, oh, this ugly-looking fellow, if he wants to stay, we're full. So I knocked on the door and I said, gather you taking boarders? Yes. I said, well, I want to stay for 3 months. Come in, she said. So I stayed there.
So you completed your PhD in Donegal, did you?
Well, I completed it in London. We did the field work in Donegal.
Oh, I see, right.
Did all the lab work back in London.
Yes, right. Yeah, yeah. So you completed your PhD then, and so that was in basically structural geology?
Structural geology field, yes. Yeah, structural geology.
And then having graduated PhD from there, you then went off to Canada.
Canada, yeah. I guess I should say there there's a... National service was still on, but coming to an end. And my mother was very upset that I never did my national service, but my two brothers had done it, said, don't go if you can help it. And as a geologist, you could get, or a teacher, you could get exempt. And I then got a postdoctoral fellowship in Canada, which exempted me. And when I came back 3 years later, I never told them, and I worked for the Geological Survey of Fiji, which would have exempted me anyway, but I didn't have anything to do with them.
Right. So from London then you went to Canada first.
To Montreal.
And then to Fiji.
Yeah, that was...
And effectively they were jobs that you were taking as a geologist.
Yeah, the awards of postdoctoral fellowships had just begun. In fact, two of us from Imperial got them because I think they woke up to the fact that they'd never given one in geology. And the other guy worked in with the government, and I worked at the university. And I did 2 years on that fellowship, and I was offered a temporary lectureship for a year, which extended me for 3 years there. And that's when I first started lecturing in structure. I spent a lot of time in the field, of course, mapping in the Appalachians, staying in local farms. We had a child there.
So you got married in...
Oh, I got married... While I was doing my PhD, and my wife was a school teacher, infant school teacher.
Right, and you began your family there?
Began a family in Montreal, yeah.
Montreal. How many children did you have?
We had two. We had a girl just before we left. We'd arranged it so that the baby would be born when I finished my my fellowship in England, but I extended for a year, so Jan went back home to have the child and then came back again for an extra year. That was an interesting time because then with two children, getting a job was essential because we'd never had any money behind us. And I was looking at the oil company, Esso. I asked, I was interviewed and sort of offered a job, and I said, well, I wanted to guarantee that the way was open to go into their research department, and they wouldn't guarantee that. And I said, I don't want to guarantee that you'll put me in it. I just want a chance to get in it. I don't want to stay a field geologist all my life. So that fell through, so I went back to the British colonial office, who had already offered me a position in, had, before I went to the Canada, they'd offered me a position in Bechuana land, actually. I applied from Fiji to go to Uganda, where my best friend was, and they said, but you could go to Fiji, which I put on the list earlier. But so we went to Fiji and
spent, what, two to three years there?
2.5 years, because I broke contract to come to ANU, but right. That's another story. Fiji was good. Working out in the bush with Fijians was marvellous. I had a marvellous opportunity. I was given a 5 months to map the second biggest island on a reconnaissance basis before they started detail mapping. So myself and one Fijian, plus a horse pack saddle and an outboard motor, we went over there and spent 6 months over there walking all the tracks and surveying all the areas and so on. But then various things happened. The social life in Fiji was pretty violent. Not violent. It made Peyton Pace look like a nursery rhyme for the colonial service business. And we got a bit disillusioned. Keith Crook came through, and I was told off to go and show him around.
Who's Keith Crook?
He's another member of the geology department. And he was coming from...
Not from ANU.
He was coming from Canada to take up his appointment at ANU.
Right, so he hadn't arrived, actually.
He hadn't arrived, no. And I showed him around in Fiji. And our parting words were, I said to him, if you hear of a jobs going in Australia, let me know. And 6 months later, he wrote and said, there's a job going here. And so I got, in those days, no interview.
1962 or
1963.
Yes.
Yeah. And by luck, I'd also met Alan White in London as a PhD student. He was on the staff here, so there were two members of staff I knew. So
Alan White was also from ANU, was he?
Yeah. Yeah. So I had a kind of a shoo-in, I guess. In those days, things were pretty casual.
And were there many people in geology in those days at ANU?
It was Dave Brown, Ken Campbell, Ken Williams, but Alan White, Keith Crook, five, I suppose. Yeah, that was right. The sixth member of staff.
So that department was just building up. That was a teaching
built up very fast. Yes.
Built
up very fast.
Yes.
Under Dave Brown, I suppose now's the time. I've just written a history of the department of 50 years since 59 to 2009, which has just been published in ePress.
We'll put a citation for that on the record.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
So I was here.
Yeah.
That's...
And so, well, basically Keith Crook and White had told you about where they were going and you...
No, I didn't know Alan White was here.
Yes.
I met him in London. I didn't know where he'd gone.
Right.
It was just pure chance.
Yes.
But so Keith, I knew, was here.
Yes. Yeah. Was there an advertisement for the job, or did you simply indicate an interest in joining the department to the...
I had no idea whether there was... I presume there was an advertisement, but Keith wrote me and told me, so I wrote in and said, I want to apply for this job, and I guess they sent me the forms, which I filled in.
Right, yeah. Yes. And a few months later, then you had the job.
I had the job offered me, so I broke contract in Fiji, and I made a deal with them to get... Because when you finished, you got a bonus on your superannuation thing, and I made a deal with them. I finished the work in when I came to Australia. The biggest work was the memoir on the Van of Leeuwen, the work we'd done there.
So you came back, you came to Australia from Fiji. You were still a British citizen, I presume, at that
yes.
time.
They wouldn't let me. I applied immediately to take up Australian citizenship, and they said, oh no, you've got to wait 2 years. So I waited 5 years, I think, and finally did the deed.
And you came and you brought your wife and two children.
Yeah.
Yes. And how old were the children at that stage?
63. Andrew was born in 58, I suppose, and came in 63.
He was five,
yeah. Just about the time we came here, Jan was pregnant. She went home for a while to have that baby.
She went back to England,
yeah.
Yes.
Back to Mum.
Yes.
And then she came back out here in 64 or something, I suppose, about a year after me. And then we had another child 10 years later, I guess.
So you had three children in the end?
Four,
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
The two came from Canada, one from England off via Fiji, and then Louise was born here.
Anyway, you arrived here with three children, with an infant, basically, plus
two
toddlers or a bit better. What was that like, Mike, coming to Australia from Fiji, basically to your first potentially tenured position?
First decent salary, yeah.
Certainty.
It was good. Dave Brown was a marvellous boss, very helpful. The whole department was very friendly, and they all the wives and kids used to meet and go out to the Kota and so on, and that, and all the staff met on Friday night in the staff club. There was, you know, a lot of collegiality or friendliness. And of course, they were all young at the same time. Housing, I mean, I think it was marvellous. We stayed in the flats at Manuka for a while, and then we were given a choice of five houses to go. And of course, one was at Red Hill, so we thought, well, that can't be better than that. So we took this little tiny house in Red Hill. But the most amazing thing, I think, then in those days was we were told we rented the house, of course, at a, I don't know what it was, small amount, 5% or something. And then we were told at the end, when our name was put on the government housing list, and when that came up, we had to either get out of the university house or buy it. So we bought it on a 4.5% or 5% interest, which was just phenomenal.
Yes. And so then you stayed on in that house and probably extended it or something?
We did, several times, yes. Yeah. It's still there, the house is still much less. We left it, they haven't done too much to it. But
did you stay in that house then for the most of the ANU years?
We stayed in that for 25 years, and then I think my wife got, cunningly, I think my wife started to believe that she'd never get me out of ANU or Canberra, which is what Ken Campbell has done, of course, stayed there. And we moved. We sold the house and moved to Kaline, and we were there for 10 years. And then when I retired, we sold up and went to Nelson Bay. Jan was determined to get me out of ANU and to go down to the coast, which
get,
we stuck
get you away from all the temptation.
Well, that's right. We stuck it for 5 years out there, and then, well, we liked it there. It was good, and that's another, I can talk about that in a minute, but we came back when my youngest daughter got married and started, had three boys in 4 years or something. So we came back and, well, we came back when the first one was born, and we're living out next to them in Womboy.
Right, so that's the...
So then I reintroduced myself back to ANU and started coming back in as a visiting fellow.
Right, so what year would that have been, about 2005 or...?
What are we now? Yes, about that time. It was 5 or 6 years ago.
Right. Back to
I can correct those dates, get them later if you like. But I guess I had outside interests in terms of geology. Dave Brown gave it up and I took over the teaching of the adult education course, and I was the last to give a geology one in 1981. No one's bothered to do it since.
CCE, was it?
Yeah, it was, and I was on the committee for CCE for several years here. I quit when I became head of the department because I didn't have the time, and also because I was cross because they were charging people $225 or something to do the course, and I said, this is ridiculous, nobody's going to come, and I can do it for nothing. But they said, no, you've got to be paid, the union rules. And so when I went up to Nelson Bay, I also then joined U3A and gave a U3A course.
That's the University of the Third Age.
Yeah. Yes. And then I've done that since I came back here.
So you've kept your hand in since you retired, which was in the mid-1990s.
97. Yeah, I kept my hand in, but it's at a level which is not up here anymore.
Sure,
I couldn't do it now. I ought to do a course from CCE, but I couldn't do it anymore.
Yes.
And he's gone up into all this ocean stuff.
Yes, I know what you mean.
And it's all way above my head.
Yeah, sure. But you're making a contribution, as it were, by providing basic...
Yeah, and I still occasionally examine an honours thesis in structure. So I've still...
So you're keeping your hand in
the more or less,
More sophisticated areas, yes. Now, Mike, when you came to ANU then, what did the university, or what did the ANU department, David Brown's department, Department of Geology, what did they have in mind for you? Did they have a need for a special skills you had, teaching or research skills?
That's a good question. I don't know that they had in mind anything for us. I think we were allowed to plot our own course. But in my case, and we'll come to this later, it ends up with not bitterness, but difference. I was very keen on, I was more keen on administration and teaching than research. Dave Brown used me as a, they wanted to start teaching geophysics. We didn't have a geophysics, and I got the job and I organised it and got people from BMR and the RSES to come and I organised the course like that. And then we had the bright idea we should teach engineering geology, and Dave Brown sent me off down to Melbourne to meet people in engineering geology, and I started a course in engineering geology, got a lot of outside people, gave some myself courses. Dave also sent me to Adelaide to a course on photogeology, so I could add that to the curriculum, for add it to the fieldwork. Some of that was my request, some the engineering geology start was his, I think. We eventually gave that up when Eric Best was appointed. He's an engineering geologist appointed to the University of Canberra, so we said to the students, you want to do engineering, go over and do it there. So I gave that up. I was Dave Brown's secretary when he was president of the Geological Society, and then later on I became president myself a few years later. I was on the faculty committees, and later on I became marshal, as you may know, for 5 years.
Yes.
I was sub-dean, and I did an extra year as sub-dean because who was a theoretical physicist? Mark Andrews had to go back to the department because they were short, had no staff. So I took an extra year as sub-dean. And then several years later, I became deputy dean. I had hopes of becoming dean. The university stupidly sent myself and Merv Aston on a higher education course in Melbourne for administrators, and then refused to promote us afterwards.
So this was a waste of their money. What, the 70s, 1970s, or later?
I can't remember when it was.
Anyway, you were provided with training in these...
I was deputy dean for several years. I stepped down for 1 year because Angela Dells wanted to get some practice at administration before she went off to become a deputy vice chancellor or something.
You must
know Angela. So that was all happy, but I was, as deputy dean, I had good rapport with Chris Bryan, but with Michael Barber it was hopeless because he'd go away and he'd leave no paperwork. It would all be locked up in his office in maths. And when Andrew Coburn wanted to, so the dean had given me something or other, told him he could have something or other, I had to email Barbara in California saying, did you really do this?
Right.
No, I didn't, you know. And then I put my name forward to be dean and got beaten. Well, I was away at the time. Dean Tyrrell, I think, was determined that he was at that stage, wanted to get outside deans, I think. That. Anyway, so I was out of the link then. And I just carried on until I retired. And I went full term. I wouldn't have minded retiring earlier, but although I was happy enough here, I felt that if I'd retired, they wouldn't replace me, so I didn't make a job for another younger guy.
Yes.
So I carried on till full term.
Now, Mike, just to go back a little bit to your wife and your children in those early days, how did your wife in particular take to ANU, and did she find it a happy place to be?
I think so. My wife's an infant school teacher, so wherever we've been, both Canada, Fiji and here, she could get a job, and she enjoyed being reserve teacher, not full-time.
Well,
full-time teaching. She liked being on call, and then she could do other things.
Including looking after the children.
She's quite keen on music and literature. She takes the U3A course still now in literature.
Yes.
And she's take gone back to the piano after many years and doing jazz piano. So, but as far as she's been happy here.
To come back to ANU, were you finding it a problem, as it were, to get engaged in the sorts of things you really wanted to be engaged in, which to me sounds like the higher levels of administration and management?
Not really. My attitude in the department was I'd prefer, like if you come in the morning and that, I'd prefer doing the office work and dealing with matters across the desk rather than go to the library and read books and so on and so forth.
Right. Research and teaching. Oh, it sounds like they fitted together as far as you're concerned.
Yeah. I took a great deal of pleasure in thinking I was administrating a department which had a hell of a lot of first-class, world-class researchers. And I was quite happy to back them rather than push my own barrow there, to the extent that I continued as deputy dean for several years, because I knew that if I didn't do that, they would have taken one of the younger guys as sub-dean. And they're all flying. And I thought, well, hell, this is daft. I'm not going to stop them. I quite enjoy doing this, so I'm going to keep doing that. I thought it would be nice to be a professor. And I applied for several chairs, four or five, but none with any success.
In other universities.
And it never bothered me that because I was quite happy here.
Yes.
But I thought, well, it's a good worth a try. The thing that really got my goat was when they brought in changed the rules here so you could have personal professors. And I was turned down, and I was called in by Dean Tyrrell one day and said,
who was Vice-Chancellor at the time.
Saying, I'm sorry, I have to tell you that you weren't made a professor because of your international research reputation wasn't good enough. And I thought, okay, you bastard. But I thought afterwards what I should have said to him was, well, look, in the last 3 years I've had to deal with their new requirements for research. We've had to develop the possibilities of combining with the University of Canberra, and we've developed courses in case it goes ahead. In fact, we did for several years give three joint courses, my course and Keith Crooks and John Walsh's with Economic Geology, Sedimentology, Structure. We did joint courses with them. And then on top of all that, they came and told us we had to move the department. And that took 2 years. So how the bloody hell am I supposed to have done any research? I didn't say that, but I would have liked to have said. Yeah, that's my only bitch with the university, I must say.
Yes, everything that they didn't take seriously the contribution that people made.
Exactly. And I think as head of, as a professor, you need to be good at teaching, you need to be good at research, you need to be good at administration. Yes. I don't think anyone can do all three.
And they tend to focus on the
research. That's right.
Let the teaching go and the management of the department or the faculty.
Yeah, I mean, we know there's plenty of examples of people who were good at research and lousy administrators, but that didn't seem to matter.
Yeah.
Well, I think that there were lots and lots of other people. I can think of people in other departments who were readers, heads of departments, who probably had the same beefs I did.
Yeah, well, I think, as you say, it has come up a number of times, this matter. And it's clear that the university's weighing of the contributions of its senior staff has really been wanting.
Yeah.
And especially, I think, there has been comment amongst earlier people in this series of interviews that there wasn't much. The thing was brought to a head by the appointment of executive deans, and presumably now there are even executive professors who are effectively now the senior managers, and so they're starting to recognise that this is okay.
I don't really hold a grudge against Dean Tyrrell, because I think he was just administering what was the then current norms. The lady vice chancellor, what the hell was her name? Paul. I think a lot of her educational requirements for staff were pretty grim. I mean, she was, I think, treating people like high school.
Yes.
With their things they had to do. I remember being interviewed at that time by, what was he called? Education Development, the department of, where Miller was the head of it. Alan Miller,
Which was effectively what CDAM has become.
They were lovely people. They did great work, I'm sure, particularly in the training courses they ran for some of our demonstrators who were PhD students. Yes. They ran some training courses which were excellent. But I was asked and grilled about our courses and that, and one of the questions they asked me is, what qualifications do you have for teaching first year? And of course I knew what they were getting at, because none of us had teaching diplomas. So I said, well, I've been doing it for 25 years. And when I told Ken Campbell this, he laughed. He said, what you should have said to her is, what qualifications do you have to ask me that question?
Now, on this same track, let me go back and try to get you to round this out. When you came, there was a young and growing department who obviously had some very some excellent talents in it.
Yeah.
And presumably from what you've already said, a lot of these younger people needed help and protection of older, of the people more senior, like you, for example, and so you took on a greater part of the administrative, probably teaching load. But leaving that aside, was it a department of high repute in the early days? Did it become one of high repute in the later days?
Yes. I mean, Bruce Chappell was world famous. Dave Brown, in a very specialised field, was the world authority, but it was so highly specialised, nobody knew what it was, really, because he was an expert in bryozoans and things. I mean, when they wanted somebody to look at the drill cores from Bikini before they tested the atomic bomb, like, Dave looked at all the fossils to sort of try and date the sequence.
Pollen and the microscopic plant.
Well, they're not pollen, these are
mosses.
No, they're marine things, polyzoans. And Ken Campbell was beginning to he was well known in Australia, but he switched his research fields two or three times until finally he worked on fish, where he's become the world's expert.
A paleontologist, effectively.
Well, he was always a paleontologist, but he changed beasts he was working on, but he was well known for all the fields he worked in.
And did that come through too in terms of the quality of the graduate students that were coming looking to get into the university and then graduating?
We didn't take our own students for PhD. We were one of the few universities that didn't do that.
Is that right? Was the...
Well, the reason being, we felt that we'd given them enough of us and that they should go overseas or to another university. Unfortunately, the other universities in Australia didn't reciprocate. They kept their own students, so we tended to get most of ours from overseas.
So you enrolled your students in PhDs at outside universities in England and so on?
Well, we didn't enrol them, they enrolled themselves.
I see.
I mean, we had a young, my favourite student, we had fights in the department about taking up arts options, for example. Some people thought it was a waste of time. I didn't. I thought it was great and encouraged students to take their arts options. And one student did Old Norsk in first year and Icelandic in second year. And then when he graduated with honours, we said, well, we better try and find you a PhD somewhere in Scandinavia and that. And we found and got him to apply to Glasgow, where they had a research scholarship going to work in Finland. And he, after he'd been there for a while, he said, you know, the most useful course I did at ANU was Old Norse. He said, they speak it here.
Yes.
He's still there. He married a Finnish girl. But other students did fine arts and things, and some members of staff, I regret, and I won't mention names here, thought it was a waste of time, and they also, again, I regret, some of them said students were wasting their time if they went into teaching, which I thought was ridiculous. So not too many of our students, a few have gone into teaching, but not too many.
Right.
But certainly the quality of the PhD...
You mean teaching at secondary school?
Yeah. One of the exceptions to that, who's done very well, although he's left since, was Stuart Turner's son. That wasn't...
So the
biggest... Everybody was... good. I mean, Tony Eddleton became famous quite quickly, but everybody was pretty well known. And of course, the big battle always came in staff meetings with cutting up the financial purse. Everybody thought Bruce Chappell got too much of the purse, but then, of course, his research demanded expensive equipment,
yes,
and that was always a problem. When I wrote my book and it was reviewed, one of the reviewers said, oh, come on, he said, you've made this all look sweet and nice. Surely there must have been some rows. The historians want to know about the rows and the disputes and that, but they're all alive still. I couldn't write those things, but what I did say and put in the book was that I told the review committee one time that I felt my job as head of the department was like a governor on a steam engine. I'm trying to stop the balls flying off in all directions, but obviously there were disputes, particularly over money. And also, because it was a big research department, there was also actually a difficulty in organising courses. Nobody wanted to change their course. you wanted somebody to move their course from second to third. Oh, no, no, the students have got to do this in second year. Too busy to change my course. No, I'm going to leave it as it is, you know, and it's all right, you know. And so, and this became a problem when we were asked to link up with REM. We started joint teaching with geography in first year.
So that was the environmental sciences area.
And at one stage they wanted us to actually link closely with SREM. And I made the point that while it was quite reasonable to expect for a geology group to actually work with these people, nobody on our staff was competent in that field. And we had nothing to do with social aspects of the results of our work. People wanted us to talk about the problems of mining in national parks and all that sort of thing. We had nothing to do with that. In running this first year course, there was always a problem because you split the course up, say, into six lectures from six different people, and you get it all in a nice logical order. And then somebody will ring up and say, look, I've got a research cruise, I can't do my lectures now, can I swap with someone and do mine at the end? So you can never get the order right. Yes. And this became a major problem. In my opinion, it's probably, I don't know if it's still going on, but it's the research emphasis became more and more and more overpowering. And I think that was to the detriment of some of the teaching. We taught good courses, but there were problems.
So your bachelor graduates, were they sought after as field geologists and as working geologists?
Nearly all of them. I interviewed. I got reports from 100 students, and they've left after they left, and they've all got jobs in different ways.
Using geology?
Mostly using geology.
Yes.
And some of them. Even one guy who said that the bastards wouldn't let me do honours, I had to do a grad dip or something. And then he said afterwards, well, I think that was probably a good thing. People who also commented on, we had big rows with OSIMM one stage, they wanted to accredit our courses. And when I was head, I said, no way. We teach subjects for people who might be working in environmental work and other things other than mining. And none of our students have ever had any trouble getting jobs anyway. They've subsequently changed that now. They've OSIMM accredited our courses. But many of the students, again, in those responses have said that they have not found a detriment in doing theoretical courses when they're doing practical work.
Right.
They found that they learnt the theory. One quoting said, we learnt the theory at uni, we learnt the practice on the job, and they seem to have done well. And have
always been well prepared, and then were able to utilise the...
If we go back to that business about not taking our own PhD students, as a consequence of that, we never had the problems with a research course that other, I think botany did, zoology did, and other people did, because the research schools were trying to pinch their best students.
Yes.
We occasionally let honours, or they requested honours students, did their theses and their main work with the research school, but they always had to have a supervisor from us. But it didn't bother us that they were then cultivating that guy to do on the PhD with them, because we wouldn't take them.
So that was consistent with your...
Yeah, so we didn't have it. We never had that problem. Until they don't now do that. When Tony Eggleton's regolith thing came in, there's no other university in Australia that taught regolith science. So if people wanted to go from honours to PhD, then they broke down. They let them stay at ANU. That was the first time after 20-odd years that we took our own...
So about 1980 or something like that.
Yeah.
You then started taking more of your own students.
Yeah, there was PhD. There were one or two exceptions. One guy who did his BSc with us worked out at Woodlawn, and he worked in the what was then BMR, I suppose. He came back 10 years later to do a PhD, but he'd been out in industry for a while.
So these days it's like a regular department in that sense that they keep their own... or attempt to keep their own best students to do PhDs?
I don't know whether they attempt it, but they do,
yes.
If they request it. I'm not sure. They've had trouble sometimes finding people to take up scholarships, and as you probably know, one of the problems with taking overseas students is you had to find fee money for immigration or something, and that became difficult. So I think now, I don't know what the situation is, but I know Tony Eggleton, certainly for his regolith group, he took on one or two of our own students as they went through, but he also had trouble getting students from elsewhere, and he had a couple of people from New Zealand, I think.
Is the Department of Geology still an independent department?
It's just since last year been merged with RSDS, and they're going through painful... RSES?
Yes, I see, yes.
They're going through a very painful merger. I'm not sure they're going to actually... They've actually started to move the building, and there's a lot of worry. What are they going to do with all the museum specimens? What are they going to do with all the teaching specimens?
Yes.
I don't think they realise how big a job that is. I've just found out yesterday that they intend to take the William Smith map, which is worth, what, supposedly $100,000.
Yes.
It's in the foyer.
Famous map, yes.
But they're not going to take my globe because they can't get room for it over there. So I don't know what's going to happen to it. I've got to find out. But, I mean, again, that was interesting. I got that globe back in the old days when we had autocratic people that ran. You may have, I don't know, you've heard my analysis of the university's three phases. They were autocratic, and then they were democratic, and now they're bureaucratic. But Dave Brown came down one day, and no one else in the department was in one afternoon. He said, "Do you want any equipment?" And I said, "Yeah, we could do with a tent for when we're supervising students." He said, "Oh, that's peanuts, something big." And I said, "Well, I did want a globe like Carey's in Hobart." "Oh yeah, how much is it?" I said, "It was £1,700. I didn't dare ask for it." He said, "Order it by telegram, because there'd been some money left over at the end of the year, and if it wasn't spent by Wednesday or something, it was going to be lost."
Yes, yes.
So I got this big globe delivered. I got students, summer in fact, summer students, I employed on the students in the summer and that to paint all the tectonics on it, and the plate tectonics was just coming out. And we painted all this stuff on the globe, and it's still there.
So is it on display in the...
Yeah, it's in the foyer of the department.
Yes. Geology will become part of earth sciences as part of this general...
It always is now. So. It is already. They call themselves RSDS. And I don't know what's going to happen. But
this is a copy of your book.
Yeah.
Of the history of the geology department.
Yeah.
We're very timely because the history is about to come to an end.
We had cleaned, especially for the photograph Dick Barwick took.
Yes.
But you can see all the work we did in painting the next. I don't know what they're going to do with it. Maybe leave it there, but if they're going to destroy it.
For what it's worth, this has become, I think, a general problem around the university of what to do with collections.
Yes, well, Ken Campbell's got a very valuable collection, and he's working very hard to try and ascertain or set up a system where it can be preserved. And he's got type specimens of various fish and so on, and
yes,
things that are worth a fortune.
And your group have a more general collection of maps and documents.
Rocks from everywhere, green rocks all over the place.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it has become a problem in, for example, in archaeology and in prehistory, where there's often fragile material that is subject to deterioration. And
what's wrong with the powers that be? Cambridge has got five museums. We haven't got one. One of the students here, he's a researcher here, knows he can go to Oxford or Cambridge Museum and he can get specimens of fish skulls that were collected from Wee Jasper 50 years ago. Still there, preserved and numbered.
But they're held there rather than...
Well, here, that was before they woke up here. There was nobody working on them here.
Well, you might have a talk to leader here, John Maloney, because I think John gets some of these issues, and I think he's encountered this before.
Right.
And I think he would be interested in knowing about what's going on in geology.
He knows.
In order, does he?
Yes. Yeah, well, Ken Campbell's talked with him,
right,
I'm sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that a more general case can be put forward to either the university or to the...
Well,
the
delicate situation emeritus faculty's in, of course, is that
they would accept encouragement to do certain things.
Well, that's right.
Yes. It is a problem, yes.
It is a major problem, and Ken's raised some money, quite a lot of money, towards trying to do something about this.
Now, you've told us basically about the terminal shape of the department, that is that it will disappear effectively into a more generalised structure which will engage itself both in teaching and research. And
I think what's going to happen, of course, is that at honours level will be the best. Now, undergraduates, I'm not sure what's going to happen, because they're going to have to march across from the RSDS building down to chemistry or to botany or whatever they want to do
for
lectures, which makes it difficult because it's a long distance. If they could just take honour students and not undergraduates, they'd probably be happy. But the other universities wouldn't be too happy to lose their good students.
Yes, you're right. And also, I think that mitigates against the purpose of a university, which is to prepare people at the bachelor level to provide the sorts of skills that there is such a demand for in all sorts of disciplines in this country and for international students as well. Anyway, in coming to this point, what in the past 10 to 20 years, about the time you've been gone from the university, or formally gone from the university, what has the department looked like compared with what it was in the early days, the days at your heyday, as it were?
Everybody's exceptionally busy doing their research. I don't know much about teaching, but I suspect that it's a bit of a chore. Dave Ellis, I know, has been honours convener for a long time, several years, which normally used to rotate a couple of times. But everybody is so busy with their research.
So like other departments, there's become a great emphasis on the research focus. There is no room, basically, for teachers in the...
Well, I don't think I should criticise that, because I'm not in a position to say that.
You don't know
that. I don't know what they really do with teaching. They've got, under the new system, the director of RSES is the head of the school, and they've got an assistant director, is his title, or associate director, who's in charge of educational matters, who does... And now he's just done his term this month, so I don't know what they're replacing him, who, with or by, how they're doing it. Their attitude is that many of the researchers could do some of the teaching, which means they could get rid of some staff. And I think in the last review of geology, they made some suggestions that several people might take early retirement. They've got too many professors now, according for the budget, because they've recently promoted several people. The only trouble with that is many of the researchers have been doing good, excellent research for years, but I don't know that they're necessarily good teachers. And I remember when I was there, one of them, who's a friend of mine, said, you know, anytime you like, I'll give some lectures for your class instruction. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but they wouldn't understand the first thing you're talking about. You're so far up. You're so far above me and everybody else that the students wouldn't have a clue.
So
it's a problem, but I guess they're working through somehow or other. But I think there must be a model. Lamont is a bit like that. Lamont has a teaching department down in the town and a research department up on the hills.
Where is Lamont?
Columbia, New York. But Cambridge and Oxford and places like that have always had research and teaching together, as we have, of course, most Australian universities.
So would you encourage a young postdoctoral geologist to come to ANU?
Is certainly this a postdoctoral level?
Yes.
An undergraduate level. There are many choices, I think, for undergraduates to do, and while I think ANU would be an excellent place for them to come, there are other excellent places too, with different focuses. We were hit to some extent by setting up the University of Canberra. Dave Brown tried to stop it in a way, and they just sacked him off the advisory board and brought in Roy Rutland from Adelaide. And Dave's reasoning, I think, was, look, they haven't got a decent library, they're not appointing top-level staff, which may not be true. And to us, anyway, what it did was it put a halt to our development, because now there's two groups teaching, and there's only enough people for one, really.
Right.
So it was, but we got on reasonably well with them. As I say, we did joint teaching later on, but there was some bad feelings between some members of staff. Not as bad as computer science or economics. I think when we were looking at that merger, they were really daggers drawn, weren't they?
So over the years, then, Mike, who have been the people who have stood out as your colleagues, your research or management colleagues, and who have made their mark for the university as a whole?
As for your university as a whole, not
yes, or for your particular activity in the university? I mean, David Brown sounds like he was an important person in your...
He was, and he was a gentle background. He didn't interfere very much. And he was very highly respected by the staff. We mostly called him boss And the other funny thing, he was wore a lab coat around the building, and occasionally he had an altercation with them, particularly when we had a big fight over bare feet. There was one guy from Research Corps came over in bare feet looking for somebody, and he said, "Is Tony in?" And Dave Brown said, "You mean Dr. Eggleton?" "No, I mean Tony." He said, "Why are you here with bare feet? Who the hell are you to tell me that? I'm the professor." "Oh." It was a famous altercation. Oh, I don't think I can answer that question. In terms of people in the department who've achieved tremendous amount, it's nearly all of them. But certainly Tony Eggleton with Regolith, and Patrick Tedeker with his marine staff. The new appointment of Arculus bringing us into volcanic geology is world class.
Who was the person you mentioned before Arculus?
Tedeker. Patrick Tedeker with his marine staff. I don't know the economic guy, Maverick Genius, now the new one. I don't know what weight he carries in this field. He's very much a chemist, I suppose, rather than a field geologist, so that he probably doesn't have such a big rapport with the mining industry, but he may do. I don't know. They may respect him well. I don't know. Steve Cox took my place, came in as a professor, and he's highly respected. His research, and he's done a lot of research with mining companies looking for complex structures in mines and so on.
Right. Amongst the more senior people then, like vice chancellors and deans, who were the people that were important, both either negatively or positively?
As a dean level, I got on Eric Batchelor, David Griffin.
But were these important people in terms of making the department or making the faculty work?
Yes, I think so.
Yes.
David Griffin once phoned me up and said, "Mike," he said, "you know, you're not allowed to have David Brown in the department." And they passed a rule, I think because of one of your professors who had retired and kept all his research grants and things like to himself. So they made a rule that retiring professors had to get out of the department. And I was a bit upset. Dave Brown had said to Griffin, I've got my room in the department, Mike's let me have the room, and that's why he phoned me up. Anyway, I went to Dave Brown and said, "I'm told I've got to tell you to, you can't have your room." But I said, "As far as I'm concerned, you can come and use it anytime you like." Because he never, and I said to Dave Brown, he never interferes. But that was the rule, but he didn't press it anyway, so. And I think he knew that Dave was still there.
Of the vice-chancellors that you encountered, like, for example, in the early days, you would have seen Crawford and...
I remember Crawford.
And then there was Tony...
Lowe. Tony Lowe, I think, was vice-chancellor when we were forced to move. We went to the... We had the opening of the new department, and we showed him around, and he said, "Oh, well, you're well-suited here. What are you complaining about?" It took us 2 years to get in and settle everything out. But I had very little... Dean Tyrrell we mostly had to deal with.
Was he...
I don't know why that was Tony Lowe came to that opening, because Dean Tyrrell was VC.
Before...
I mean, that move was horrendous, and I know it affected you guys as well as ours. Now, I don't know that we've had much... I don't know that you do it at a department level, even the head of the department level. I mean, I sat on so many committees...
The department itself, did it have much interaction with other departments in terms of cooperative ventures in teaching or research?
Well, eventually with SREM, not so much. I think Ken Campbell tried to put on a course on evolution with zoology, and that didn't go anywhere. Zoology wasn't interested. Tony Eggleton ran a course on mineral chemistry with John Broomhead, I think, for 3 or 4 years. But the chemists wouldn't recommend their students to take it, so it fell apart. It was only geology students doing it. We had tenuous relations with geography. Ken Campbell hated geographers, wouldn't have anything to do with them. I got on very well with Diana Howlett. Eventually, two of our ex-PhD students lectured geomorphology in Chappelle, Chapwater Records, John Chappelle and Brad Pillins. Were both our students, and our students were not necessarily encouraged, but allowed to do geomorphology as part of their geology degree. So there was links with geography, but they didn't extend far enough to allow us to want to link with SREM.
Patrick Dedeker gave a lecture to Shrem, the one he came back to me afterwards. He said, I'm not going to lecture to these people anymore. They're a bunch of ignoramuses. He said, I wrote NACL on the board, and a student put his hand up and said, what's NACL? Yes. And I didn't... There was a problem with chemistry. We, for some reason, weren't allowed to make high school chemistry a prerequisite to do geology.
Is that right?
I used to at University of Canberra. So when we did joint teaching, and we had people from Shrem doing, particularly Shrem, but others also, but when we had art students coming in to do geology, they had done no chemistry. So Bruce Chappell had to give a crash course in chemistry to first year students at extra thing and lunch times. So that was a major problem to do with cooperation. Plus the Shrem were interested in the personal effects of what happened with water and landscapes,
right,
and so on.
Social consequences. Well, just remind me what SHREM stands for. That's the
School of Resources and Environmental Management.
So it was probably the collision with the arts level and sociology level students. That
yeah, who was the prof there who left? It was a CSIRO guy who came and then left the room. Don't get me wrong, I think we respected what they were doing. But it was totally different from what we were doing.
And yes.
It was very hard to see how we could join up.
It's hard to teach across that
That's
boundary.
Right.
That
and I think cultures. Still, from the latest review in 2007, I think there were criticisms of that first year course.
Yes.
Still, trying to mix geography and geology. The people with us who were most likely to be associated, there was Keith Crook. And Patrick Dedeker should have been, but he... was put off by that experience.
Right, yes.
And he's pretty high powered.
Probably felt that this was a bit of waste of his time to be talking to people who didn't know what NACL stood for.
Right.
Okay, Mike, well, let's move on now to something I'm interested in, and I think the ANU would be interested in, and that would be your contribution to geology as a profession through professional societies or organisations. Were you involved in these in any way in your time at ANU?
Yes, I was secretary of the Geological Society of Australia when David Brown was president. I guess the main thing I did at that stage was to rewrite the rule book. I then became president much several later.
So you were president of the Geological Society of Australia? Yes.
Vice president and past president, so you're involved for 3 years.
Was that an active society in terms
of? Oh, yeah. President, 1983-84. I also helped set up the specialist group in structural geology, which was in a time when we were forming these separate groups to try and interest, and there's a whole 5 or 6 of them now, to group together specialists within the umbrella of the Geological Society. And I was executive secretary of a group for the Geological Society that produced the tectonic map of Australia in 1971 with a lot of help from BMR. So I was a Geological Society representative, if you like, on that committee.
And was that a big society? What was what its total membership have been? Some hundreds?
Oh, yeah, something like now, about 2,000, something like
Is
that.
It?
As the height of the mining boom, it was about 2,000.
Yes. Well, maybe you might like to comment on that. Over the years, presumably as mining booms and resource booms have come and gone, I mean, I've heard it anecdotally, even as a biologist, that there were changes in the demand for undergraduate places in geology because of the changes in expectations about the opportunities as these booms came and went and turned into busts.
Yeah, there was a boom bust mentality where at one stage when there's a boom on, the companies tried to persuade second year students who had summer jobs to stay on and not go back to uni and things like that, and then the bust comes and several of them either went set off as independent consultants or flocked back to try and get back into BMR or EXO again. So it's always been a little bit dubious. But again,
so, what would it be like these days, would you say, or at least in the days around the time of your retirement in the, say, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I think that there was a... Nickel became dominant. Everybody was crushing into there. And then there was a big gold boom. And now it's much more general. There's still a gold boom, of course, but...
Right, it's...
And oil. We... In the department, though we had a petroleum geologist there, we didn't really specialise very much in petroleum geology. A few people went into it, but that became very big, of course, and people rushed into that. So there were a whole series of rushes and slacks and rushes and slacks, but I think most of our students managed to keep the wolf from the door anyway, even in the slack times.
Would that be true these days? Would geology graduates be finding job getting easy?
I'm not in a position to say, but I would have think so. I haven't seen, in the JOLSOC magazines I get, I haven't seen any comment to the otherwise that there's not good employment opportunities. They're much wider now because there's all these environmental impact statements and things that geologists are going into.
Now, I notice there's mention in your CV of you being a fellow of the Australian Institute of Geoscientists. Is this a subgroup, as it were, of the geologists? This was
set up in the first mining boom because it turned out that geologists are not registered, and there were rules that at one stage even a prospector or a driller could actually sign a report that would go to the stock market, and there was some hanky-panky going on and a few sub-criminal or even criminal activities. And so the society tried to set up a registering system. OSIMM already had this going, but you had to be a corporate member of OSIMM, which meant you had to be sort of 10 years experience or something like that. So we set up Geoscience Institute to just register geologists as professionals. It was first set up in Perth, because what the government does is find a lawyer who hasn't got too much to do, or a department. They were set up rules in Western Australia, and then it became national.
This is about 1980, by the look of your...
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. At the time, I joined, but I'm not a member anymore. I didn't need to be, because I'm not doing consulting.
Yes,
and so on.
Yes.
Do a little consulting. So but now it's a... If you're actually consulting and that, it's not absolutely essential, I suppose, but it's a good idea to be a member of either Geosciences, either that or a member of OSIMM. And because of signing... I mean, we actually... In those bad old days, we actually had one student who came back and asked me what to do. He said, asked by the company to orient drill holes deliberately down the dip of the ore body. In other words, if the ore body's going like that, instead of drilling through it like that, when they say on the stock market they've got a 2-metre intersection of so many percent gold, it looks good. But if you can drill down like that, you can get a 20-metre intersection.
Yes.
It looks, and it's dishonest. And
so this was a professionalisation of the of geologists that was meant to help protect the unwary.
That's right. But I had nothing to do with it setting up, really. You know, I might have been president at the time we started, I think. But
what then, in terms of your own work as a geologist, Mike, as a research or field worker? What were the important elements of your career while you were at ANU?
At ANU, I guess the first thing we did in 67, 68, was soon after I came, we got a grant, ARC grant, the first ARC grant ever given to work overseas, I think. And myself and a guy from Macquarie went to South America, down to the bottom end where the mountain chain in the Andes turns through 90 degrees. And this was to prove a hypothesis of Sam Carey's from Tasmania, that the mountain chain was formed straight and then bent. We went down there to collect samples to do paleomagnetic work, which we brought back. We were down there for 3 months. Interestingly, nowadays, you know, that grant was $15,000, and that paid our airfares and all our equipment and everything for 3 months. Amazing. It did, because a while afterwards, we did get the paleomagnetic work done at ANU with the help of a research assistant, and that was published. I regret to say it's been more or less ignored, but other work has been done, and I'm not sure people think too much of our results, but our results seem to suggest that it had actually been bent. We wrote that up, which was the main point of going there, and I think one of my deep regrets in research was that we never went further and wrote up anything much on the structure or anything
between two of us, the other guy moved to America, and we never got down to it, so never got done. It's too late. Other people have been working down there, but that's a disappointment. Of course, in Canada, for my postdoctoral fellowship, and working again in detailed structure of the Appalachians, and again, a very long time later, I took a study leave in 1976 and completed the first draft of that work that I'd done in 20 years earlier. And that's been published as a big memoir for the Canadian Survey, complete with detailed maps, structure of part of the Appalachians. As a result, I guess because of that interest on a study leave, I made an application to a group in Sweden who were doing an international geodynamics project. And they got money to do a traverse right across the Swedish Caledonians of the same age as the ones I worked on in Canada, and in the same ones I worked on in Donegal. So it was a continuation of that interest. And I went over to Norway on study leave for 3 months. Interestingly enough, the reason they'd asked me to work in Norway was because it was a Swedish project, but the Norwegians didn't want them to work in Norway. Again, some of these total coincidences. They wanted me to work in Sweden, in Norway, for their project. And incidentally, you better get in touch with the people in the Norwegian Survey and let them know what you're doing. So I went along there, and there, lo and behold, the head of the survey had been a postdoc, a visitor to ANU when I first came. So I'd met him and knew him. Mm-hmm. And the guy who was working for the Norwegian government right next to where I was working had been a PhD student here at ANU too, so I was in. And that was convenient. I don't think they knew that when they offered me the scholarship to do that. So that was a very interesting piece of work, and I worked that up, and it's been published. We also ran, again, this same International Geodynamics Project. I ran, organised a whole series of cross sections across eastern Australia, and we did one from Wagga to Batemans Bay, where we did detailed structural work again with the help of two research assistants, and that was published through the survey, New South Wales Survey. I did some work here with my first PhD student on the Ordovician, just locally at Queanbeyan, and I continued that now and did several summers working down the coast, and eventually published some material with a guy from Macquarie who also was working down there. He had many more students than we did, so he had a big share of the work there, but we got together and wrote a joint paper and ran an international, interestingly, we ran an international symposium in Bermagui based in the village hall, which was quite interesting. So local, yeah, and I did some work up in the centre, a little bit contributed to a BMR map, and the same at Mount Isa. I was going up there to supervise PhD students, so while I was there I spent an extra 2 or 3 weeks and did a little bit myself. That was just to make it worthwhile going up there and contributed to their maps, but I never wrote anything on that. There's a group called the International Basement Tectonics, which I went to one of their meetings in Canada when I was on study leave. And then I invited them back here, and I organised and ran the 9th International Basement Tectonics Symposium here, and edited the proceedings. That was in 1992-91. And then I did detailed study of the structure in a mine now down near Bredbow. Somebody asked me to look at the structures of the new chief geologist, and I'd said, oh yeah, well, why don't we put an honours student on it? I wasn't all that keen on going down a mine at my age. And anyway, he said, no, you're on the honours work. We need it done by a professional. So I said, well, OK, I'll do it as long as Ken McQueen, who was the economic geologist at UC, came in as a joint member. And the two of us went down there and mapped the thing. It was a bit hair-raising because they'd reopened the old mine, BHP mine from 1932 or something, so there were all these rotten timbers and things in that and there, and we were supposed to have free access on a Saturday, but they were still blasting and working while we were there. We had to keep running out, so it was a bit hair-raising, but we managed to actually map the detail of the mine and prepared that for publication.
We sent them the report, that's right, and they actually paid us, which was something. And a week later, they closed the whole mine down, and it all. The guy who was the chief geologist who employed us quit and became the government advisor to the Irish government back in Dublin. They crushed up a pile of stuff about as big as this room and finally got it down to a bar of gold about as big as you could hold it like that in your hand, which was quite interesting to see them doing that, because you couldn't help looking to see, when is the door locked, can I get out with you? So that was a local. And I also, not research, but I also, and I guess the university wasn't too happy about that, I also did some consulting work for a local quarrying company, ReadyMix, looking at local rocks to see if they were suitable for their purpose. The university didn't seem to be too keen on that. They thought that wasn't geological research, but I felt it was a contribution to the local
industry.
Yeah. And that's about all, I guess. Mostly structure. I also did some work on quartz veins down the coast in Upper Devonian, which I did the study leaving Bristol, and compared the results there with stuff they've got, because the Upper Devonian here is almost identical. Put my photos on his desk and they look the same as his.
And are quartz veins of special interest to geologists?
Yeah, because they quite often contain minerals, yes. Other than quartz. The ones we were looking at didn't, but the way they fill gaps, so if you deform the rock and make a crack, then it fills up quite often with quartz. In limestone country, it fills up with calcite, of course, but in sandstone country, it fills up with quartz. And many of the mines, like Victoria and Captain's Flat and all these things, have got mineralisation as in quartz veins. So the geometry of quartz veins, although not mineralised but there, is of great interest.
So that's the association between gold and quartz veins and broken down quartz in stream beds and so on.
Well, that mine study, Kawara Mine near Breadbone, we recognised 7 different phases of quartz veins. Only, I think, 1 or 2 of them were mineralised. The others were barren, so
yes.
They come in at a different time when there was not.
So other sorts of minerals can be found in quartz veins as well as gold. So are there any people that you want to mention, Mike, especially about their contributions to the development of your life as a geologist or your career as a university manager?
And about the last part, but as a geologist, I think the greatest debt I owe is to Wally Pitcher, Professor Pitcher, from Imperial College, that later became Prof at Liverpool. Well, he ran the program in Donegal for many, many years and was a marvellous teacher, and it really set up my principles of work ethic and so on.
Yeah, so an early teacher, as it were, who then provided some of the qualities and the standards.
He was a granite man, of course, but I went out to Donegal to look at the structures around the granites with him, and he became world famous, but in his granite work. And he actually came out here and stayed with us at one stage to attend one of the granite symposiums that Bruce Chappell was running. So he was a major influence, and the other obvious one was David Brown, who just encouraged us in everything we wanted to do and helped us.
So David had some inspirational qualities about him for his staff generally, would you say?
Yeah, he was a great leader, a very quiet man. It was an encouraging person. That would be the best description of him, I think. He never pushed. I guess occasionally he did say no to people, but if he could, if you asked him if he wanted to do something, if he could, he'd do it.
And he provided good.
Certainly gave me tremendous support in anything I wanted to do.
Maybe I could ask, just finally, and I should have asked this question early on as well. In your family, was there a tradition of scholarship or of learning and so on that was important amongst your parents, for example? Or were they just ordinary folk that became?
I was the first member of our family ever to go to university.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
My father should have done, because he was quite a good scholar. He learned French and German, and his painting was
frustrating for him because he never sold very much, but he did it for many years. That was an inspiration to us boys, I suppose.
So he was an enthusiast for the arts and for learning?
Not really. I mean, he didn't know anything about music. He wasn't at all interested
in music. No, but as an artist, presumably, he had
anything to do with art, he would talk about and that. But and he never forced us. In fact, he gave up painting for many years, and there was, in our bedroom, there was two big paintings which we weren't allowed to touch, and many years later they all dried out, of course. They got thrown away, but we weren't allowed to touch them as boys. But I guess when we were growing up, he didn't paint much, but then he took it up as we grew up again, because he did it earlier.
Yes.
So he was a great inspiration in that sense, and he encouraged us to do things. My mother was a dressmaker, and of course, in those days when you got married, you had to leave your job.
Yes.
And she did dressmaking for friends and so on during the war. Made people coats out of army blankets and things like that during the war.
Well, to bring this full circle, what about your own children? What are they doing, Mike?
The oldest boy is the bane of our life. He went to Armidale to study, but he played around so much that he failed first year, so we cut him off and said, yes, that's it. He eventually got into ANU to do first year law. How he did that, I don't know. And then he failed, so he quit that. So he's worked in all sorts of insurance jobs, selling houses, business.
Right.
At the present moment, he's been headhunted. He was headhunted by a headhunting firm, and eventually he was made manager of New South Wales for their firm. And then they went bankrupt or something and sacked him, and he's now in recruitment in the government, and he seems to be doing well for himself.
What's his name?
Andrew.
Andrew, right. Yeah. And the next one?
Kerry is a school teacher, followed her mother, and went to Sydney Teachers Training College. Subsequently, she's turned her dip ed into a degree with the University of Catholic University here.
Oh, the ACU, yeah.
And with the last year, upheaval with the education system and the change of thing for preschool and that, she's got so jacked of it. She's now gone back to that university and she's employed part-time to run teacher training program. So she's quit teaching.
Right, so she's now a teacher trainer instead.
Yeah. And the third one, she didn't like school. She left school very early.
What's her name?
Simone.
Simone.
She left school from Narrabundi before she didn't even do year 11, I don't think. We made a slip up because we went to England and she did courses in England and that, but we didn't carefully watch what she was doing when she went back to Tilopia, and she didn't take any subjects that continued into year 11 and 12. And anyway, after a little bit in year 11, she decided she wanted to quit, and she quit and went to work for Pegasus, riding for the disabled.
Oh, yes.
And because of that, they gave her the dole early. Because she was doing that, and she did that for a couple of years. She's now a teaching assistant working with handicapped kids and running three horses on a property living quite close to us. She's mad on horses.
Is she? Yeah, that explains Pegasus.
Yeah, and she's still on the committee of Pegasus, I think. That is Louise. Louise, she took a degree at ANU in linguistics. Couldn't go on to do an MSc, MA, or she could have done, I think, but she was advised not to. And she suddenly decided that she wanted to go into speech therapy. She applied to go to uni to do speech therapy, and after writing to five or six universities, all of whom charged $25 to register, turned around and said, no, you can't study here because you haven't done any chemistry, and speech therapy is a
quasi-medical
science, so she couldn't do it. So she ran restaurants. She ran Rose Cottage out at Tottenham. Worked in various restaurants for a while. And then she got married, and well, she's had three kids in 4 years, sort of thing, which is
right. So she's busy. Basically a full-time mum.
Yeah. She's just started a job at Jim Baru.
And a few words about your wife. What's her name?
Janet.
Janet.
Only Janet.
And she's...
She was qualified as an infant school teacher, but she was teaching here in in the ACT, and they came and interviewed her, and they gave her a teaching certificate for juniors, I think.
Right.
So she's just a general teacher.
Right.
Interesting. Well, she wasn't interested in music when she was teaching. She's taken that up since.
Yes, that's what I was getting at, I think. Yeah. Yes, so...
And she's always, she did piano as a girl at school. And teaching's an ideal profession for a wife of a geologist who's moving around all over the place because
yes.
she can always get a job.
No, I guess that's true, yes.
And she's taught in Fiji, she's taught in Canada.
Well... Mike, we're near the end of this. Is there anything I might have left out in this partial cross-examination?
Not that I can think of. You've been very thorough. Actually, one of the most interesting consulting jobs I did was, somebody passed it on to me, was the Yass Council looking for a cemetery site. They wanted a lawn cemetery. And I went out there with the town engineer or whatever it was, and they thought a certain part would be good. They wanted me to look at it, but the owner of the land said, no, it's no good, it's no good. Well, it was good. It would have been good for a lawn cemetery. But the interesting thing was that the grave digger, whatever they call them these days, was tagging along, and he tugged my sleeve, and he said, shh. He said, whatever you do, he said, don't let them extend the present cemetery. He said, it's so bloody rocky, I have to put them in vertical. Is that still going? I don't know. You can cut that out. That was, again, part of a local, what I thought was an important local...
A local contribution.
Contribution, connection, yeah.
Geology to industry.
This is an addendum of the talk given by Mike Rickard on the 3rd of March 2011 and represents an addition of comments which Mike wanted, including some acknowledgement of other members of staff to the work that he did at the university, and also includes a summary of the scientific work which Mike did.
You asked me about people who, in the department and that, or in the university, who've been helpful in my career, and I thought afterwards I ought to mention Doug McAlpin, who was faculty secretary, and taught me an awful lot about how the university worked, because I was sub-dean with him for 3 years.
Right. Yes, he was secretary of the science faculty, as yeah. I remember. Yeah.
And among the technical staff in the university, the department, great help from Henry Zapaznik, who was HTO, Robin Westcott, who was all things, OHS officer and tech officer to Tony Eddleton, but also helped me with all sorts of things. Lee Belbin was the research assistant, who worked with me and Keith Crook, did a great deal. And the other one I wanted to mention, because I got something back from him to do with my history, was Jack Pennington, who was a research HTO there, but he was very keen on athletics, veteran athletics, and he dragged me into, I became a high jump coach for a while with under Jack's insistence, and also I helped Jack with Alan Weatherby set up the athletics testing thing. In fact, I wrote the constitution for them, I think, and
right.
He used myself and another geologist as markers of the ordinary man in the street, and nearly killed us, and we said that this was too hard for ordinary man in the street. So that was them.
Good, thanks for that.
The other thing, I don't know if I mentioned, after I retired, I worked with the Coastal Patrol in Nelson Bay and became chairman of the Lighthouse Trust and ran a small lighthouse museum for 5 years, which was a very interesting thing. I thought it might be worth summarising my publications in groups just by four regional map bulletins. Major structures, I wrote 23 papers, minor papers 12, technical reports in Fiji 10, book reviews I've done 20, abstracts and notes about 30, and I've written 2 lab manuals, one of which was translated into Chinese. So I thought that might.
Yes. Okay. That's useful
to go in. The other thing, which may or may not be interesting to put in, was when I first arrived. Professor Carey was running the symposium in Hobart, and he complained to David Brown that nobody from ANU was going. So Dave Brown sent me, and being very naive and thinking I was representing the department, I took careful notes and sent a survey around the department when I got back, and nobody was the slightest bit interested.
Who was Professor Carey?
He was the famous professor of geology who believed in expanding Earth in University of Tasmania.
Right.
And probably one of the most famous Australian professors went all around the world proselytising for his theories, which
right.
nobody ever accepted.
Yes. Good, okay.
So they were all the things that came to me in bed after your last session. Whether you can use any of that.
Now, would you like to... You've mentioned your publications record of various sorts. Do you want to make a little summary of the research fields that you were engaged in your time at ANU?
Yeah, they were mostly to do with structural geology, structure of rocks, and working down the south coast with several honours students, and working in Tumut with Keith Crook with honours students, but I was concerned particularly with looking at the deformation of the rocks, and wrote several papers on that work with students. But my biggest input, I think, is in mapping, and as I say, I produce four regional map bulletins. Three from Fiji, one from Canada, and I contributed a little bit to some BMR ones here in Australia, but this is the one from Canada. It's got a hefty bulletin and it's got a huge map with lots of structural details. It's
right.
the results of what, 3 years field work.
Right.
And because of that, I then became was the sort of department's lead in field work, so most of the field excursions I either went on or led over the whole of my time there.
Right, for undergraduates.
For undergraduates, yes.
Yes.
Mm. And I didn't have very many PhD students, but a few I had were working with the what was then BMR or EXO, working out in the centre at Alice Springs and at Mount Isa where I supervised their work.
Right. Good. Okay.
But I haven't been focused on, except for the general bias is in deformation of the rocks, but I've scattered myself around far too much, really, to concentrate on one feature.
Right, yes.
I mean, I came here having been, I think, one of the early people to recognise certain factors about rock cleavages, and I did very little about it here, but watched two or three other people go ahead and push the subject forward, which I just sat on the sidelines and threw brickbats occasionally.
Right, yes. Good, okay. Anything else that you want to add, Mike?
No, the Fiji work was... published a fair bit on Fiji and that, and still, actually, just this week I've sent a draft of a copy to Ian Williams for a report on an area in Fiji which Ian did some dating for us, which stems from 20 years ago. But we had an idea about something, and we took students out there on a student field excursion. We collected some rocks when that student excursion, brought them back and gave them to Ian.
So these were ANU students, were they?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that paper has now gone into Ian, ready to be submitted to press, so it will be now 20 years after I left. It'll be my last contribution, but I don't think of anything else. I mean, there's...
Good, okay. Well, don't try to press it too hard, because, as I said...
I was just thinking how to summarise this box full of stuff, but they're all different things. But,
none of the other people who've spoken in this series have attempted to go through the detail of their scientific careers or their scholarly careers in the case of historians and so on. This is not an oral history program about your science. This is about your ANU years.
We just
want a general picture of who you were, what you did, what your impressions were, and how it all worked out in the end.
When I mentioned Doug McAlpin, and I mentioned, I should have said, I don't know if I did then, Giles Pickford too, because he was my mentor for 5 years when I was, I had the exalted title of chairman of the graduation committee, about which without Giles I wouldn't have had a clue what to do, and sitting in front of with the DVC and various people from different departments to sort out graduation matters. Yes. And that was an interesting time.
Right. What you might like to explain for the ANU audience is who is the marshal, or what does the marshal of ANU do?
Well, he carries a ceremonial staff, and the Esquire Bedell carries an orb or something, which they put onto a rack during the ceremony. But as marshal, theoretically, I'm supposed to be there to protect the vice chancellor and the visitors. It only once nearly came to having to thump somebody over the head, but when Bishop Tutu was there, sitting next to him, and then afterwards there were a few student rows. But there was one time when some stupid student chained himself to the railings outside the university house, and Giles rushed up and guided me, told me to go through the common room and take them out the other way while they dealt with him.
Yes.
But so I never actually got to actually thump anyone with the marshal's staff.
Well, I hope it's supposed to be a ceremonial.
That's right. Yes. And part of the reason I was chosen, I think I was the only one who could fit the uniform. I think the huge big robe. But that was quite interesting. I had to sit on all these graduation ceremonies, and including the School of Music one, which was always more interesting because they had a little concert with it.
That concludes the addendum for Mike Rickard's talk given on the 3rd of March 2011. In this interview, we heard from Dr. Mike Rickard, previously reader in geology at the Australian National University and currently a committee member of the ANU Emeritus Faculty. The interview is part of Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program and was conducted in March 2011 at the Faculty Office. Interviewer and audio producer was Peter Stewart.